Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here on KLW. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking this week with Retina, the graffiti artist turned artiste who's inspired the bold look of the current production of San Francisco Opera's Aida. I'll also talk with San Francisco Urban Film Festival founder and executive producer, Faye Darmawi. Actors Lance Gardner and David Everett Moore are in studio to talk about the West Coast premiere this evening of Safe House at the Aurora Theater Company. Jerry Tenney shares some details about the Yiddish Culture Festival, and regular contributor Peter Robinson muses on the month of November. Stay with us. CLES California, the organization that has entertained and engaged the Bay Area since 2003 with an exuberant celebration of Yiddish culture, continues this fine tradition with two separate events coming up. The first, in partnership with the New Yiddish Theater, will be Cabaret by the Bay at the Osher Marin JCC in San Rafael on November 20th at 5 p.m., followed 2 weeks later by workshops and a different version of Cabaret by the Bay at the JCC East Bay in Berkeley on December 4th. These events will also serve as release parties for Jerry Tenney's newest CD, Jerry Tenney and the California Klezmers, a retrospective. Jerry has been a Bay Area presence for many decades and in many communities. He's a founding board member of CLES California and now president. Jerry's well known as a children's entertainer and educator, klezmer band leader of California Klezmer, and a folk singer who specializes in progressive and labor songs. No stranger to radio, some of you may be familiar with the music in the background. It's the theme music for the show he hosted for 10 years on KPFA, Gershon Yunk. Yunkle. The uncle, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Please, help me with that introduction.
You got it right to the last letter. I said, this guy's going to nail it. And then he blew it on the last letter.
You know, that's the glory of live radio.
But you got the vowels right. Mostly people get vowels wrong, but you missed the consonant. Well, all right, let's talk about
what. Well, tell me what that show is called.
The Gershon Yunkle Show.
Gershon Yunkle
Show. And that's my Yiddish name.
Ah.
And that song is called Gershon Yunkle's Tango, which I wrote. And named it after myself and stole something from Beethoven, which if you played it further on, and it's...
What happens if you play it backwards? Is it?
It sounds terrible. I mean, there's some people who like music like that. I happen to be old-fashioned, analog, straight-ahead, you know...
Well, we still have turntables
from,
here, so...
from Bach, you know, from, you know... Anyhow. Yes, hi.
Hi, welcome.
thanks for having us on.
First of all...
Yeah.
Oy vey, with a schmear.
Oh, God, no.
What a week we're having.
Oh, my God, I'm still processing. You know, what can I say? I have my hat with my Bernie pin on it still as a young man, just to remember who should have ran who would have won. Bernie and I are kind of contemporaries, actually. He grew up in Brooklyn and I grew up in the Bronx around the same period of time, and he went to the University of Chicago and I went to Hunter College in New York.
It's neat.
New School for Research.
I had kind of a later experience in Brooklyn from, let's see, 97 to 2002 or so. Great town. At least at that time it was.
Yeah, I love... Anyhow.
Yeah.
Okay, enough about me. Now let's talk about me.
This is all about you. This is your CD release.
Right.
And your...
Well, it's called a retrospective. It's like 30, 35 years of music. Some of it recorded live at various places. Some of it recorded in a regular professional studio. Some of it recorded at my semi-professional studio at home. And just an idea, just to give people an idea of what I've done over the last 30, 35 years in terms of klezmer music. I've had kid CDs out and singer-songwriter CDs out and a Yiddish children's CD out. But this is my first klezmer Yiddish thing for big people as well as young people.
Oh, nice. And how long have you been involved with the festivals?
I've been involved in the festival since the beginning, since 2003. I was a founding board member, and I've been the president for the last, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. Judy Kurnofsky is the person who does most of the work. I call myself the pretty face at the top.
There you go.
If you, this was TV, you could see.
Absolutely.
Why,
hold
why
your
that,
face up
why,
to the microphone.
Why that would be.
Yeah, lovely.
So, you know, we're hoping, you know, I'm here mostly to talk about the festival, and, you know, I'm playing a part in the festival. But the first thing that's coming up is going to be a cabaret at San Rafael at the JCC up in Ocean Marin on North San Pedro Road. And there's going to be Voretsky Pass. You have some Voretsky Pass music somewhere.
I do, and they've been guests here before.
Oh, they have been guests here. You know, I'm going to be playing some with Voretsky Pass.
Nice.
Which I've known them for years and years, and some of them are, in fact, are on the CD that I'm putting out, because one of the people in Voretsky Pass is my wife's ex-husband. Yes, that's what it is. And we're still friends.
Okay.
That's all fine. Yep. And Naomi Newman, who probably most people know, an amazing actress, and Jake Marmer, who's a klezmer poet, who I don't know what that means, although he's great. I mean, I've heard him, and he's fabulous. He's just a very excellent. And Anthony Russell, have you had Anthony on the show?
Have not, no.
He's an African-American who converted to Judaism after hearing Yiddish music. I mean, and he kind of sings like, I thought he sounded like Paul Robeson, singing Yiddish, which is great. But he actually learned from the person who taught Paul Robeson to sing Yiddish, whose name is Sidor Belarsky. And Anthony's quiet. He was an opera singer and a bass baritone and just amazingly talented. So it's going to be a great show.
Well, let's get some background on you for when you, obviously in your family, exposed to Yiddish culture and Yiddish music early on.
Yeah, I mean, not deeply, but you know, my mother's side, people sang and sang a lot of Yiddish songs, and my uncle was a fabulous violin player. On my father's side, my grandmother came from a town of Kalamea, was in the Kalamea Klezmorum. She was a klezmer musician family. Her last name was Spielman, which means player person, and her family was from a group of klezmorum that went around in that part of southern Ukraine and played klezmer music.
Help us out with what defines klezmer music.
Well, the actual meaning of klezmer is a vessel of song. So the idea is that you're supposed to play your instrument as if you're singing. So that's kind of how the term derived. In the old days, there was no such thing as klezmer music. You were a klezmer, but there was no klezmer music. It was then, as the klezmer revival arose somewhat in the West Coast here, there was the klezmorum who named themselves, and then Capella on the East Coast, people started to give the music a name, like, this is klezmer music. Just in a sense like Bill Monroe and bluegrass music. I play a lot of bluegrass music. I mean, there was no bluegrass music until Bill Monroe named his band the Bluegrass Boys. And then it became bluegrass. It was just all country music. And before, the late 70s, early 80s, there were klezmer musicians, but they weren't really, nobody called them klezmorum. You were a klezmer, but it was never, I don't know, maybe I'm too finicky a point. It's probably somebody out there is going to call and say, wait a minute, I read in this book that I...
What's he talking about?
This guy, he thinks he knows something. Nah.
Fair.
Three times fair. Fair. But you do, in Yiddish, if you spit, you have to do it three times.
That's fascinating. Because I'm serious. No, because it's an opera tradition that I think comes from Russia that they say toy, 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 which is
I bet you that's exactly
that's the spitting.
I bet you it's exactly the
that's
same
fascinating.
Thing. I never knew that.
Yeah.
See, I come on to be interviewed and I learned something. This is so great.
That's KLW for
you. That's what you're here for, right?
So the actual tunes, are they all folk-based? Are they all old tunes? Or is there such a thing as creating a new klezmer tune?
Well, yeah, all the above.
Okay.
You know, I mean, a lot of the tunes that were recorded or played were folk tunes. A lot of them had their origins in liturgical music. So sometimes you'll hear, if you're familiar with the service, which I'm not that familiar with the service, a little bit, they took snippets of liturgical music and then made them into dance tunes. And then people created their own tunes. And sometimes one of the stories that I heard that's so great is that a lot of these tunes didn't really have names, or they had three or four names. And everybody had it, where, depending on where you are, you had the same tune and you called it something else. And sometimes you'd get into the studio, what I heard in the 20s, and they'd say, what's the name of that song? And says, I don't know, let's call it Nifty's Egana. Nifty Branwine was a great place. Oh, that's my own, it means Nifty's own, my own tune. So there's a tune called Nifty's Egana, which he made the name of in the studio.
Well, let's hear an example of some of the vocal style. This is going to be from a live
this
performance.
This is a live recording at, we used to have a show called Klezmer Mania that Kyle Flexer and Mike Marshall put on back in the 80s. And this is my band performing at that, recorded live by my wife, sitting in the audience on one of those great Sony Pro record. Remember the Sony Pro cassette recorders? They were so fabulous. I love them.
Here's music from Jerry Tandy's new CD.
And right? You can't sing along in the chorus. The chorus is, I da die da die 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 die, I die die da da die 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 die. And that means, I da die da die 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 die, I die 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 die. Just in case you needed the translation.
More with Jerry Tandy in just a moment.
Schatz, es ist morgen gekommen zu meinem Segen. Ich hatte mit der Mare, hast du doch Regen. Sie hat die Rettung gehört und gelebt, gar um sie. Bis ein Gläser der Maske, es ist allein gegeben. Silly musky silly cockle and mama grand.
I hear you out there. I hear someone in Bernal Heights is not singing. Wait a minute. Come on. you there in Colma. Oh, no, you can't sing because... Yeah.
That's from Jerry Tenney's...
That's a San Francisco joke.
Jerry Tenney, yeah, I know, I know what you're referring to.
Right.
Jerry Tenney and the California Klezmers, a retrospective, is two events for Klez California celebrating the release of this new CD. Great stuff.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear a little bit more before we say goodbye to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'd like to make sure I talk about the Berkeley one.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, before, should we
start it?
Well, Berkeley, we're going to have another cabaret with all different people and workshops. That's the interesting part of the Berkeley one. There's going to be workshops on I'm going to do a kids workshop, free for kids, acting workshops, instrumental, how to play various styles of how to play instruments. I'm doing a lecture on radical Yiddish songs that were collected in the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s. There's a dance workshop. It's fabulous. If you go on CaliforniaKlezmer.org, you will find all the information that you need.
I believe it's Klez California.
Klez California. Yeah,
there we go.
Thank you.
KlezCalifornia.org. You'll hear some great music by Jerry Tenney and a bunch of other folks as part of the Cabaret by the Bay, both here in Berkeley and in San Rafael.
Yes, ma'am. Sir.
Remind me the track we're going out with.
We're
going to
go out with track, is it 14?
You tell me.
I think so.
All right.
Whatever it is, here it goes.
Thanks, Jerry.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Thanks for coming in.
Funky mandolin.
Montag, Bull bis Montag, Bull. Donnerstag und Mittwoch Bobes, Donnerstag und Freitag Bobes, Schabes in den Ovener Bobes, Kugille, Sonntag weiter Bobes, nee, 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 nee. Sonntag Bobkies, Montag Bobkies, Dienstag und Mittwoch Bobkies.
Jerry Tenney, one of the featured artists for Klez, California, the Yiddish Cultural Festival with workshops, Cabaret by the Bay in Berkeley and San Rafael. More information at klezcalifornia.org. Good afternoon, David Latulip with you for Open Air here on KALW. We'll learn about the West Coast premiere of Safe House at the Aurora Theater before the hour is out. And I'll talk with Retina, the graffiti artist who has inspired the really incredible bold look of San Francisco Opera's production of Aida. Well, next, the San Francisco Urban Film Festival gets underway this Monday with an opening night keynote and storytelling workshop, Why Create Just Cities? With me is Faye Darmawi, the founder and executive producer of the SF Urban Film Festival. It's an urban planning film festival she founded some 3 years ago to inspire civic engagement using film and storytelling. The film festival brings together her backgrounds in urban planning, housing, finance, and screenwriting, and apparently a personal passion in building community wherever she goes. Faye, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks Happy for to having have you me.
Here. We'll be joined shortly by one of the filmmakers that is featured. Three of the films that are featured in this festival are Another Way of Living, The Story of Reston, Virginia, which will include a screening and panel discussion on the 16th, Occupy the Farm, which will be screened on November 17th, and HBO's Show Me a Hero Weekend Marathon on the 19th and 20th. Tell me about your passion for urban planning. When did that kick in?
Well, that kicked in pretty early in my life. I grew up in a household where we talked about community development and serving your community almost daily. So urban planning seemed to be the profession where you could support yourself and build community at the same time.
Well, the festival is called, subtitled, Why Create Just Cities? So can you answer that question for us? I mean,
sure.
It may seem obvious, but...
Yeah. Yeah, so the theme this year is creating just cities, and the reason why it's important is pretty obvious, that we have incredible income inequality. We have, looks like, two different countries, and... We need to unify ourselves as a country and as a community, and the only way to do that is to honor each other and justice.
Were you a fan of the San Francisco Beautiful Movement as it was originally envisioned before the 1906 earthquake put the kibosh on that whole thing?
Am I a fan of that? I'm not so much a fan of that. It was... a way to highlight sort of big commerce, I believe, it didn't really highlight the actual neighborhoods and communities that already existed in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It was trying to create this sort of narrative that San Francisco is this up-and-coming world city.
And it harkened back rather than forward, too, I think, in terms of the style of architecture to almost Greek. Lots of columns everywhere.
Right, the classicism, grand gestures versus the understanding of how neighborhoods and communities actually function.
So this opening film and discussion on the 16th, Another Way of Living, the story of Reston, Virginia, what is that other way of living?
So the film Another Way of Living will be screening at the AIA San Francisco. AIA stands for the American Institute of Architects. And Another Way of Living, the film is about Reston, Virginia, which is a planned community that's located between Washington, D.C. and Dulles Airport, that this one man named Robert Simon actually founded on the principles of racial and economic diversity. He self-funded it, and it was pretty successful until a bunch of a few economic downturns made it impossible for him to continue, other than pulling in a petroleum company to invest in his dream.
Mm.
So the film, I'm not going to give it away, basically asks if a one man's dream can continue after a large corporation gets their hands on it.
And that'll be screened on Wednesday the 16th at the AIASF, the Architects Place. Where is that exactly?
It's on Sutter Street.
On Sutter Street. Information at sfurbanfilmfest.com. Also, we're joined now by phone, who's joining us from the middle of the country somewhere, Todd Darling, who's director of the film Occupy the Farm. Todd, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, Occupy the Farm, what are we talking about here? I understand UC Berkeley is involved.
Yes. UC Berkeley owns a research farm, a place called the Gill Tract on San Pablo Boulevard, that's sandwiched in between Oakland, Berkeley, Albany, and Richmond. It sits in Albany. And the story is about 200 urban farmers who walk onto this publicly owned research farm and plant 2 acres of crops in order to save this land from becoming a real estate development. And I was able to follow the 3 weeks that they were occupying the land, getting the crops established, and then followed the story on both sides through the next couple of years. And the resulting feature film is called Occupy the Farm.
And Faye, were you familiar with the whole situation there before you came across the film?
No, I wasn't. I was so surprised that I didn't hear about it, but I was so happy to come across the film and that Todd Darling actually has an office in North Beach where I live. So we're going to screen it at the Exploratorium, which is also in the neighborhood. And the Exploratorium has been a great host to the SF Urban Film Fest. This will be our second year that we're there.
Todd, what are you doing in Wisconsin, is it, besides pulling out your hair after the results of Tuesday?
Actually, I'm in North Dakota.
Oh, North Dakota.
I'm at Standing Rock.
Fantastic.
I'm looking out across a tent city right now.
Our host of Your Call, Rose Aguilar, was there for a good part of a week. Absolutely amazing story, and this just is not going away.
This story is not going away, no. This is one of the most fascinating places on the planet right now, and I think pivotal in the U.S. Conversation at this juncture.
And let's hope something is resolved before January on this. My God, I can't imagine what's going to happen after that.
Yeah. That would be speculation on my part to guess what's going to go on, but the process here is riveting.
Are you perhaps thinking of are you doing some background for perhaps a film on the situation?
We've been producing short pieces. They're going on to our page called Media Bridge Dispatch, and I've been working with other news outlets. I had a piece on Vice News on HBO, and I'll be working with Vice News again coming up. So we're making as many things as possible. While camping and searching for electricity to charge batteries.
That's amazing. I wish I could be there. I'm there with you in spirit, of course, and continue your excellent work, and we look forward to seeing what comes out of it and from your perspective. Thanks for taking some time today, Todd.
You're welcome.
Todd's film, Occupy the Farm is being screened on the 17th at the Exploratorium. Doors open at 6:30. Again, more information at sfurbanfilmfest.com. Faye, anything else we need to quickly touch on? Adventures in Urban Storytelling is happening on the 18th.
Yeah, that's a night where we're going to feature hip-hop artists, an editor of a global blog on urbanism, and a crowdfunded film project called One Day in America. And also, just to go back to Todd, he's also going to be there at the film screening on the 17th. And unlike other film festivals, many of our events are free. And if they're not free, they're $10. So please come on by.
Indeed. Thanks for coming in and spending a little time with me today, Faye. Faye Darwitt-Marwi is the founder and director of the SF Urban Film Festival. More information at sfurbanfilmfest.com. Well, the Aurora Theater Company presents the West Coast premiere of Keith Joseph Adkins' Safe House. African-American Shakespeare Company artistic director L. Peter Callender was making his Aurora directing debut with his production. Peter appeared in Aurora Theater production of Master Harold and the Boys, Breakfast with Mugabe, The Soldier's Tale, and Permanent Collection. The play is set in northern Kentucky in 1843, nearly two decades before the start of the Civil War, and explores the life of one free family of color and the tensions that arise when two brothers have conflicting dreams about how to secure their futures. Actors Lance Gardner and David Everett Moore play the brothers in Kentucky at the center of the play. Lance makes his Aurora stage debut as Frank. He's performed in productions with the California Shakespeare Theater, Theater Works, Berkeley Rep, Marin Theater Company, Encore Theater, and Just Theater, among others. Welcome to you, Lance.
Thank you.
And also making his Aurora stage debut is David Everett Moore as Addison, whose credits also include Cal Shakes, Marin Theater, and Just Theater, as well as the African American Shakespeare Company, San Francisco Shakespeare Festival, and Word for Word. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you.
First of all, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and what's been going on this week?
So much.
Everyone's talking about what's the next step. Well, how are you guys feeling?
I'm feeling bad. I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling concerned, and I'm trying to figure out what signs that I'm seeing are signs that need to be acted on, and how to act on those things. I was speaking with the cast and crew and director yesterday, and I came to a realization. I've been struggling with the place of art in a world of activism, and I came to a realization that I believe that art is not the action, that you can't change things through art, but that art is the call to action. And that you can sort of hold up the mirror and get people moving by putting those things in front of them.
Well, your final preview. How about you, David?
I mean, I'm again feeling sad, angry, lost. It's a lot to process. But you know, I think that art is one of the ways, like Lance said, that we can always hold the mirror up to nature, as Shakespeare said. And one of the things that I love about theater is that we can tell stories in this medium that can't be told in any other medium in this way. We have, in general, absolute carte blanche to tell the stories that we need to tell, and that is the glory and the power of theater. And so I think, you know, stories like these, especially Safe House, become even more pertinent in times like these.
Carte blanche for now.
Right. Lance Gardner and David Everett Moore playing in Safe House at the Aurora Theater. Your final preview was last night, opening tonight. Now, has these seemingly apocalyptic events of this week informed or even changed the way you're approaching the production?
I don't think that it's changed
Lance Gardner
approach to production. It certainly changed something that's happening inside of me, but but you can't change history. The history of slavery in America exists, and that's part of the story that we're telling, and it becomes I don't know if it's a more important story to tell, but it's certainly pertinent in these times.
Well, Lance, if you would, give a brief introduction. Tell us more about the storyline.
Sure. There are a couple spoilers that I won't give away, so it's hard to give a real overview. But essentially, this is a story of a family living in a house that acted as a safe house for slaves in the 1830s and 1840s. And because of that, they're now living under some punishments imposed by their local sheriff.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story about a family that simply wants to be themselves and are no longer free to do so. The head of the family, Addison, is an ambitious man who wants the best for his family and wants to be able to be all that he can be. And in order to try to achieve that, tough decisions are made, and there are consequences for those decisions. Hmm.
You've worked with Peter Callender before?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm.
And what's, his experience in with the African American Shakespeare Festival and companies is legendary. He must be bringing an interesting perspective to your and informing your role somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, Peter is an amazing actor, and when you have that experience that you can also bring to being a director, it really does just open it up in a different way, because a director who is also an actor can explain things in a way that a director who's not an actor might not be able to touch or specify that emotional heart of that moment. But an actor may have those words, may have that nuance, and so it really does help.
And the production is running through December 4th at the Aurora Theater, auroratheatre.org, for more information. So it kind of raises a fundamental question of who deserves loyalty and protection with this, the conflict that's going on between you two.
It does. I think the world is full of difficult questions, and everybody has a different idea of what freedom means and what you're willing to sacrifice for your freedom, and that's really at the heart of this story. And I think it's, for better or worse, at the heart of the American story right now.
Well, I wish you a wonderful production. I'm anxious to see it now as well, and given everything that's been going on. Thanks for coming in today, and again, information at auroratheatre.org. David Everett Moore, Lance Gardner.
Thanks for having
us. What can I say? we've got to get through this all together.
Yeah, right. Work. It's going to take work.
We'll do it.
Indeed. Well, on a different note, two visually spectacular productions are rounding out the fall production calendar at San Francisco Opera. They're oldies, but goodies. Puccini's Madame Butterfly and Verdi's Aida. Thanks to the visionary director Francesca Zambello, the artist Marcus Lewis, who goes by the name Retina, was engaged for a truly innovative look to the sets and backgrounds for Aida, which opened last week. Retina was raised by a single mom in L.A., and his journey from graffiti tagger to artiste is a fascinating one. His work has been exhibited at institutions and galleries in L.A., including the facade of L.A.'s Museum of Contemporary Arts, or MoCA's Grand Avenue location, in Miami, London, New York, and Hong Kong. He's also collaborated with VistaJet for some painting on their jets, with Nike, Louis Vuitton, and Chanel for special projects and fashion collections. His work is inspired by calligraphy and hieroglyphics, developing his own language in bold colors and shapes, which director Francesca Zambello was drawn to and seized upon to evoke the mythical past of the Egyptian setting of Aida. Coupled with set designer Michael Yergin and costume designer Anita Yavich, it makes for a stunning interpretation of this classic opera, for which you'll have 9 more opportunities to catch before it closes on December 6th. I caught up with Retina at the Opera House last Saturday, just hours before the opening night performance. Retina, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time today on this, of all days, opening night for Aida.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited about the opening tonight.
Well, this must be quite a jump for you from being exhibited in major museums, but starting out on the streets of L.A., now to the world of grand opera, which, thanks to you, will be transformed, I think, after tonight. When did director Francesca Zambello first see your work?
I was first approached by art dealer of mine, Marcia Goldberg, maybe about 2 years ago. We were in Art Basel in Miami, and I was painting a mural, and then she came up to me very excited, and she said, "Marcus, you wouldn't believe it. I just got a phone call from Francesca," and she was like, "This is the real deal," and, you know. And so it was about 2 years ago, and we flew out to Washington to meet Francesca, and it was pretty amazing.
So did you know of her initial involvement in the opera world then or not?
No, you know what? I actually didn't, but I was already kind of on a high just from thinking about it, about what could happen, you know, the idea of the opera. And, you know, even after I met her, you know, I went to the Kennedy Center and I saw how grand this opera house was. You know, I think the President Obama had just kind of done something there for Al Green. He gave him an award. So it was all these things leading up into when I met her, and it wasn't really till after. I met with Francesca a couple times. I would sit there and like Wikipedia her, and I would just sit there probably for hours going through, you know, her awards, you know, where she teaches, and obviously I was very aware of her stature in the world of arts and opera.
Well, I imagine that you're used to pretty much having free rein about what you do and when you do it. Although site-specific works, of course, have their restrictions, parameters, was it difficult for you to conform to both the strictures of what was required of you scene by scene in the world of grand opera as well as the schedule to produce the final product? When did this first get on your calendar?
You know what? It, in the beginning, it was a little tricky for me. I'm not going to disagree with that. My first task was to come up with, like, opening scene and a sketch, and then I started researching. You know, I bought a lot of books and was looking at a lot of opera productions that had happened in the past, and I was conforming to a style that was probably based off of an old flyer, one of the first early flyers that I could find of Aida. And when I turned it in, I think I thought it was a great drawing, a great starting point. But I wasn't staying true to kind of what it is that I do. And so Francesca was like, "Look, Marcus, why don't you just work? Why don't you just do what you're already doing, you know?" And then she had gave me some ideas, and I had talked to Michael Yergin as well. And basically what happened was I ended up just going through my archives, you know? And so she was like, "Just feed me what you got, what you've done, stuff that you haven't shown anyone and things that you've been working on and stuff like that." And so that's kind of what I started to do. I was like, "Oh, you know what? Like, you know, here are some shoots that I did. Here are like some installations and some different works like that." And then there was a lot of things that were done that were, now that I look back at the work that I did in the past, they were almost like preliminary sketches. Although they were grand in the scale where they were at, but then they worked out for the production here you know, which was really, really exciting to see how, you know, ideas to be revisited and then to see how that they could conform to the stage, you know, and how they could move around and how they can evolve and all that. So it was fantastic.
A lot of your work is very calligraphic-based, calligraphy-based, based both on ancient scripts and fonts. Will everything that we see, obviously the calligraphic elements in the opera will be very obviously yours. Will everything else we see on the stage also be have your hand in it in terms of backgrounds and other elements?
No, you know, I think for the most part, all the sets, yes, but as far as, you know, the costumes, there's the costume designer, the, you know, the dance, I didn't really have anything to do with that. And I think the you know, the musicians as well, the opera singers and all that, I can't take any credit for that, can I?
Well, let's talk about the scripts that we will see on large scale, on something as large a scale as the stage of San Francisco Opera. Mm-hmm. Will they be telling us something, or are they your own secret language?
No, they're you know, there's a combination of pieces in the opera, in the production, that do say things, but a lot of it really. What Michael and Francesca were able to really notice in my work, which was actually exciting to see, was there's a lot of elements of the figures of male and female, you know. Those two letters, those two characteristics, or two characters in my font-based work are actually repeated quite a bit in my actual paintings and my murals and whatnot. And there's a good portion of it here that's actually represented throughout it, you know. So the idea behind that is unity, right? Is the unification between two people. And there's a scene in the triumphant scene where it's actually repeated quite a bit, you know, and that could just represent, you know, male and female, and represent just the, you know, the challenges when there's two females and one male, or vice versa.
So more a symbolism than a language per se.
Correct.
It was great to see. Well, you mentioned, please.
I'm sorry. The main drop in the beginning, on the first scrim that everyone will see. That one does say, birds of a feather flock together.
You mentioned that you look back to early Aida productions, but on the visual end of things. Mm-hmm. When were you first familiar with the music of Verdi's Aida?
Well, that it was around the same time, you know. And then I'd spoken with a couple friends of mine that were Italian, and you know, I spoke with the ambassador of the United Nations, and who's an Italian gentleman, and then he was telling me about, you know, that Verdi was on the dollar bill, you know, and I never knew that, and then it made sense to why they call it green sometimes, although it's spelled a little different. So it was all new to me, you know, to be honest with you, yeah.
You're often seen in some videos when you're doing your larger scale works with a pair of headphones on. Mm-hmm. Were you jamming to Verdi when you were working on this particular project?
Yeah, you know, I think I was jamming to a combination of music, but you know, definitely, it was funny because I was watching the conductor the other day when we were here for a rehearsal, piano rehearsal. And I've always kind of mimicked the movements in my studio. So I think while I was working on this stuff, I definitely was jamming out to it for sure, you know.
I know you work with young people quite a bit, and it was great to see on YouTube some of your work, specifically at LA's Museum of Contemporary Art, Grand Avenue, and the Louis Vuitton Young Artist Program. What was that like?
That was actually really fascinating, you know, working with the kids from the Louis Vuitton Young Arts Program was great. Jeffrey Deitch, who I owe a tremendous, a form of gratitude, he knew that I had a fascination of working with kids, and I had never really done it, like, from an institutional side. And so it was exciting to see you always remember the freedom that you have when you're young, you know. And I try to allow kids to have as much creative freedom as they can. And in turn, I try to learn from them. I don't really try to teach them. I could tell them what I've been through and what I've learned, what I've achieved and how I could have done it better. But when it comes to the creative spirit, I always kind of notice that I end up learning from them as well to have that, you know, that unhindered, you know, maximum creative spirit, you know. So it's always a fascination. And I think it's going to be a continued effort on my part that I will continue to work with kids.
Well, early on, graffiti has such a bad rap as being a nuisance, but graffiti art has becoming something quite different and trendy, museum-worthy.
Right.
And I know that you prefer the public aspect of creating graffiti in terms of an installation.
Right.
Now, do you find it, the move to a contemporary museum, something that's limiting or maybe expanding your base?
I think it would be expanding. Yeah, you know, when you're a graffiti writer, you do prefer the probably the adrenaline of the legal rush of, you know, climbing the place, you know, all the intricacies that go about it, not getting caught, not getting, you know, in a fight with some gang neighborhood, or all the different challenges, and then trying to come up with something actually beautiful to look at. You know, there's different levels, obviously, of graffiti writers and whatnot. But, you know, here in San Francisco, I'd have to say that, Barry McGee, has been one of the forefront of artists that crossed over, you know, a long time ago. But still always remained true to what he was and a genuine person. And from that, you know, there's a whole slew of other artists as well. But I've always remembered, he's one of those artists that you could see how he could transform a place and an institution. I believe here in San Francisco, Aaron Rose put on a great show at Beautiful Losers at Yerba Buena, which then led to, Jeffrey putting on the big show Art in the Streets at the MoCA in Los Angeles, you know. So, you know, San Francisco has always been a really great place that had a lot of style, a lot of hand style. And I used to come out, you know, I have quite a number of friends out here that participate in it. And so, you know, the challenge comes where we all kind of came from a letter form based work. I know that there was a time here where there was a lot of figurative, work being displayed as well, which was probably preliminary to what street art became, right? You know, there's the diehard graffiti writers, and then street art is now the more accepted term. Now, but it all kind of comes together, and it's allotted a lot of people opportunities and to become, you know, professionals, so to speak, in a field. And then now, you know, we move on to, like this building here wouldn't be one that you would want to paint on. And there might be a couple people that might want to try, but but for me, to know that I had been coming to San Francisco for so many years and always had joy of seeing the great works of arts that are here, and then to now be able to participate on this grand scale at this opera is very fascinating. I'm very grateful.
Back to your particular mode, your particular language, and the beautiful calligraphy that you create in your own language. Has that become standardized? Do you have a vocabulary now, or is it always changing?
You know, it's always changing, actually. It goes through periods for like a couple of years or so where the letters are strictly the same. And then depending on, you know, the brush changes it, the tip or whatever you're using, the environment, and just age, too. You know what I mean? Like when I first started, a lot of my work was very, very complex, and it was a part of a wild style. And then now I've stripped it down to basic, you know, symbols that are just circles and lines. You know, it's not really that complicated. But in doing so, it's interesting. It actually kind of made the work more complex, you know.
And back to the whole schedule of putting on a production like this, was it? It must have been interesting to work with. I mean, you've got a village of people that are working on this production and working on the backgrounds and getting your art installed and created. It must have been a very different experience for you.
It was, you know. There was times where I've never worked on a production like this. So when we went to the Kennedy Center, I got to see the stages in the back and whatnot. And just to see the grand scale of things, you know, and I'm used to painting some very large, you know, buildings and whatnot. But to, you know, I would always ask Francesca, well, how do these things fit? You know, that's why the artwork had to work a certain way where, you know, if it travels, you know, things need to move in and out. They have to fit for a stage. So there's a lot of complexities that I found. I was intrigued by the craftsmanship, by all the people that work behind the scenes to actually make this happen. And I've always been fascinated by the process, you know.
Congratulations. I know you worked on this wonderful project with Aida and the San Francisco Opera. Are other operas looking interesting to you, perhaps down the road?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think it's fascinating to. I'm looking at the historical marks where, you know, with the artists that have been in the past. And to be grouped into that, you know, productions that David Hockney did and David Sally and whatnot. And, you know, I think this is going to be an exciting year for me. And I'm looking forward to it. And thank you to everyone that allowed me to be a part of it.
Well, San Francisco is getting a great dose of you today or this next several months, not only for Aida performances at the San Francisco Opera House, but the wonderful show at the Legion of Honor.
That was another pretty big deal for me as well. And again, grateful to Francesca to introducing me to Renee and to the people, great people over at David as well, over at the Legion of Honor. That was another thing that was kind of mind-blowing to me. You know, to be influenced by this culture and then to be able to, you know, grace the walls where, you know, these two mummified beings are at. It was fresh. San Francisco's definitely showed me a lot of love. I could have never imagined.
Thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you for having me.
Aida runs through December 6th and features Leah Crocetto in the title role, Brian Jade as Radames, my friend Raymond Aceto as Ramphis, and Anthony Reed as the King of Egypt in the cast. Learn more at sfopera.com. Performances run through the 6th of December. Also some terrific video shorts at sfopera.com on the creation of this spectacular production. The exhibit of Retina's work at the Museum of Honor, Museum at the Legion of Honor, The Future of the Past, Mummies and Medicine, runs through August 2018. Great chance to catch this incredible artist. Regular commentator Peter Robinson has some thoughts about the month of November.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And I was extremely conscious of this change in season as I was hiking down Tennessee Valley in Marin only last week. And you have that feeling that November is here and winter on its way. Already the evenings are getting darker. A crisp offshore wind whistles up the valley as you catch your first glimpse of the Pacific. And came to me those closing lines of a poem by Thomas Hood, actually called November. No warmth, no cheerfulness, no healthful ease, no comfortable feel in any member, no sheed, no shine, no butterflies, no bees, no fruits, no flowers, no leaves, no birds, November. And I think partly the poets, particularly the East Coast poets like Robert Frost, are extremely more conscious of this change of climate. Here's a couple of lines from a Frost poem. Not yesterday I learned to know the love of bare November days before the coming of the snow, but it were vain to tell her so, and they are better for her praise. Frost had that uncanny ability to write about the interaction of the relationship between individuals and nature in a remarkably simple and eloquent manner. In many of his poems, he recognizes the beauty of nature, but is also puzzled and sometimes troubled by the continuous change. And I think if I've been aware of change, it's certainly been over the last 30 days. Now, as I grew up in England, November the 5th has a slightly different meaning. It's known as Guy Fawkes Day, harking back to 1605, when the Guy planned to blow up the House of Lords on the day that James the 1st was scheduled to open Parliament. So for kids, they run around with the poem, Remember, Remember, the 5th of November. And still, on the 5th of November, you'll find bonfires and fireworks and a emblem of the Guy as he gets set afire. Over here, we've just celebrated or passed All Souls Day or the Day of the Dread. So to some extent, for many different cultures, November is a time of remembrance. And of course, nowhere is this more significant than the end of the First World War, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, known as Armistice Day in November 1918. Although it would be later, not until 1954, that Veterans Day was added to the calendar. In Europe, it is still referred to as Poppy Day, when people wear red poppies in their coat lapels in remembrance of the fallen. These poppies bloomed across the worst battlefields of Flanders in World War I, and their brilliant colour was an appropriate symbol of the blood spilled in war. So for many reasons, November is a month of memories, many of them with sadness. But on the other hand, the difference between what I call Poppy Day and Veterans Day is that Veterans does celebrate the living. Veterans remembered for their service, to acknowledge their contribution to our national security, and to underscore the fact that all those who served, not only those who died, have sacrificed and done their duty. But when I look back on the calendar for November, I always remember that we finished the month with Thanksgiving, first proclaimed a national holiday in 1789, November the 26th, by President George Washington. It's also a presidential month, as many presidents, American presidents, were born in November: James Polk, Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, Warren Harding, and James Garfield. And of course, Abraham Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address on November the 19th, 1863. Perhaps, sadly too, the most tragic day in recent history, November the 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated. So to some extent, it's a bleak month. Emily Dickinson concluded, "November days seem to me the Norway of the year." And yes, she was writing before the shopping spree of Black Friday. But if we're out of the recession, let's not go black. Let's just settle for the word bleak. However, we live in California, and no matter the month, the sun always shines. So even in this November, let's face it, you can't trump that.
Oh, my, Peter. So close to Election Day. You had to get that in there, didn't you?
Well, I missed out on the email. Do you notice that? A whole talk about November and not the magic E word.
Thanks very much, Peter, and enjoy your November.
Thank you.
And that is indeed open air for this bleak November 10th, 2016. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe. My thanks to producer Niels Swinkels for keeping the open air wheels well greased. If you've got a show segment, you can dash me an email, david@klw.org. And a reminder that all of our shows are archived at KLW's website, klw.org. Thanks for listening.